crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome to today's show of Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuktikal. We're coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel, as per usual. I'm actually recording this show a little bit earlier here on Sunday because in a couple of hours, I'm going to have the privilege of giving Melanie Phillips, a British journalist, a well-known journalist around the world, who sometimes resides here in Jerusalem, a tour of the excavation sites on the Ophel and in the city of David, just below the Temple Mount walls. And it's kind of a matter of chance it actually came about, this tour, about a month and a half ago. My wife and I were just walking down the street here in Baca, close to the German colony, and we're on our way home, and this lady passed us and walked, turned to the right into a store. And as I was just processing her face, I told my wife, that really looks like Melanie Phillips. And she's obviously a pretty well-known face, especially in British British politics, just because of her commentary on British politics on the BBC and such. So I followed her and went into the store, just into a small grocery store behind her, and just stopped in front of her as she was getting something out of her bag. And I said, I'm just going to kick myself if I don't ask you if you're Melanie Phillips, because you look very much like her. And she said, well, that's because I am. And so we just discussed a few things about her articles and her blog and what she's doing in Jerusalem. It was only a couple of minute discussion. And I briefly told her who I was as well. And we left it at that. She gave me her card, and that's about it. So when I got back to our apartment, I emailed her and just explained who I was and that we're here as part of a college from America. As part of our work is doing archaeological excavations in the city of David and the Ophel with Dr. Elot Mazar. And I just offered her a tour of those sites if she wanted to do that, I'd be happy to do that for her and whoever she wanted to bring along for a tour of those sites. So she accepted. We had a few emails, went back and forth to try and figure out a time that we could do it. And I got an email, I think it was on Thursday last week, that she's going to be in Jerusalem and she could do it this Sunday. So we are doing it today. Now, why am I doing it? That's a good question. Why am I giving a tour to this lady? It's not just because she's somebody famous and I wanted to get to know somebody famous. It's much more important than that. It's because I think it's supremely important for influential people, such as journalists, to be included in the history of Jerusalem, to be fully aware of the history of Jerusalem, and so that they can shout it. They can shout it out to this world of what's actually been uncovered. Yes, the world is fully aware, well, not necessarily fully aware, but they are somewhat aware of what the Bible says about Jerusalem being the capital of the Jews throughout their history. Going back 3,000 years, they know that, but a lot of people would say that that's just a fabrication, history recorded after the fact, and we don't know how reliable it is. Well, I think it really behooves those with their hands in the dirt in Jerusalem to show the world that it is real, that history is true, and you can see it and you can touch it. And these journalists then can use what they see with their eyes to then put it down on paper and tell the world about what they witnessed on a tour in Jerusalem. Now, the areas where we're going to tour, they're in what the UN Security Council Resolution 2334 says, illegally occupied territory of Israel, that the Jews are actually living in these territories illegally, that they don't belong to them, that they don't own them, and that they're breaking the law by being there. Well, every stone we look at today is going to be in the eastern part of Jerusalem, that's going to be in that area that is determined by the UN to not be belonging to the Jews. And every stone wall we look at today is going to show that that's an absolute farce. An absolute lie, really. You can't show a people that belong in a land going back, you know, 3,000, 4,000 years as you can show the Israelites or the Jews living here in Jerusalem today. And we can connect that them, those people that live here today in this city, to a history of thousands of years ago. And that's really what we're going to see today on this tour. She wrote a column for the Jerusalem Post, Melanie Phillips did, back in January 5th. This was this year, soon after that UN Security Council resolution. And it was entitled, Real Liberals Must Shun Palestinian Colonialism. And this is how she started that piece. I'd just like to quote from her. Right now, this is again Melanie Phillips. She said, with Israel still looking down the barrel of a diplomatic gun as the Obama presidency approaches its final days, it's high time to change the narrative. Western progressives define themselves through various fixed positions. They are against racism. They are against colonialism. They are against ethnic cleansing. They are against police states. And they are against anti-Semitism. That's what they say that they're against. These Western progressives, as she calls them. She writes then, so there is a political agenda that is surely tailor-made for Western liberals and left-wingers to shun and condemn as an utter negation of all they hold dear. So she's saying there's an example of this, of what they should be shunning. The goal of the Palestinians is the colonial conquest of another people's country. Now, that sentence there is going to upset some people to say that the Palestinians themselves are actually the colonial people trying to make a conquest of another people's country. That country, she continues, is the State of Israel, the homeland of the Jewish people whose unique connection goes back antiquity, and it does. And she fills us in some history here. She writes, in the 7th century, the Arab world conquered Judea as the ancient kingdom of the Jewish people had been known. And the Jews had previously been driven out of this land by the Romans, who renamed it Palestine in order to conceal its Jewish history. Now, this is going back 2,000 years ago to 70 AD when the Romans booted out the Jews. And from that time forward, 100 years later, they started calling it Palestine. Not Judea, not Yehud, nothing related to the Jews, to try and wipe out that bit of history. Then towards the conclusion of this piece, she writes, those people have no knowledge of the Middle East or Jewish history, speaking of those progressives. They have no idea that the Jews are the only indigenous people in the land of Israel who are still around. They have no idea that the Arabs themselves are the historic occupiers. And they are. Now, I'm not necessarily for booting out, you know, every Arab out of this state of Israel, but it's good to know your history. It's good to know that the Arabs did come here after the Jews were here originally. Then she writes, they have no idea that Israel's, quote, occupation is nothing of the kind and that settlements are lawful. They have no idea because nobody has ever told them. Nobody's ever told the Western progressives about this history. The delegitimization of Israel rests on the hijacking of the language so that the victims are turned into the oppressors and vice versa. We must now reclaim language for truth and justice. Palestinian colonialism means the Palestinian cause is one that liberals must condemn and shun. Conversely, progressives who support Palestinian colonial conquest and the ethnic cleansing of the Jews from their historic homeland are nothing of the kind. It's time to start letting them know. That's what they want to do from East Jerusalem. They want to remove the Jews, ethnically cleanse the Jews from East Jerusalem from their historic homeland. And as we're covering in this show, we're even seeing an attempt to discredit Israel's biblical history as well. Or at the very least, not to give the history of the Bible the full weight that it deserves. And today, as we tour these sites, we tour the City of David, we tour the Ophel excavations, just below the Temple Mount, Just below that huge southern wall of the Temple Mount, overlooking these excavation sites, we're going to dig under that period. And we're going to dig down 3,000 years and find lots of remains from not just Jewish history, but Israelite history as well, especially during the reigns of King Solomon and King David. That's what we're going to see. Now, we've noted on this show the cry of biblical minimalism that really talks about the reigns of King David and King Solomon as being petty tribal chieftains over a petty hill village in the 10th and 9th century. And really, by discrediting that history of David and Solomon, these so-called scholars are discrediting the founding of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Those that would argue that Jerusalem has been the capital of the Jews for 3,000 years could say, well, I don't know about that. David and Solomon, people say they hardly were powerful personalities, and that city that was meant to be the very center of their so-called empire was absolutely nothing. That's what they say. Well, in a few hours, I'm going to get to tour Melanie Phillips and a couple of her friends. And you know what we're going to focus on? We're going to focus on that very period. The period of these petty tribal chieftains over a so-called petty village. And the stones and the walls and the other artifacts that we look at are going to show. Just by looking at them, you can tell that this was no petty tribal village, Jerusalem, during the time of King David and Solomon. No, it was large. It was the center of their growing nation, and that is going to be beyond refute. And I hope by conducting this tour that influential people such as Melanie Phillips write about it. I don't care if she mentions that she had a tour necessarily, but I do care that it will, this knowledge of the existence of these artifacts, I hope that underpins her writing when she talks about Jerusalem's history, and that it increases her fervor and her passion. Not that she really needs more of that, as you can tell from some of the videos of her. But I think it is going to have a dramatic impact on her because it's her history. She's Jewish, for one. And I think she'll be amazed at what has already been found testifying to that period. It might not have received the publicity that it needed in the past. It comes, discoveries, they come over the news wire and then they disappear. But the history is still there. It still stands in the archaeological parks here in Jerusalem, and you can see it. You can see it, and that's what we're going to see today, this history of Jerusalem under King David and King Solomon. Jerusalem was the capital of the Jewish state going back 2,900 years. Before that, it was the capital of the Israelite state. And when we come back on this program, we're going to look at what David did in choosing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and how he rallied the nation around Jerusalem to unify it during a very difficult time of their history. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.FM, where history and prophecy come alive. They call it the City of Peace. But it is filled with violence. Yesterday, bloody crusades and sieges. Today, terrorism, rocket attacks, and stabbings. Intense international pressure, but no diplomatic solutions. This is Jerusalem. No city has suffered like it. Will there ever be peace? God says yes. There will be peace in Jerusalem. and not just for the Jews. It will be a peace that spreads to all people. How will God bring peace to Jerusalem? Request your free copy of Jerusalem in Prophecy to find out. The answer comes straight from your Bible. Peace is coming soon. Act today. Please visit thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. Today we're talking about King David and his relationship that he had with Jerusalem and establishing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Remember, when David became king, he was not inheriting a singular nation, but in fact, two nations. This would have been a really tough time for Israel. King Saul was the king over a unified Israeli state or Israelite state. But at his death, we have the tribe of Judah following David and David reigning over them. And he didn't reign from Jerusalem. He reigned from Hebron in the tribal region of Judah towards Jerusalem south. And you had Ishbaal, who was Saul's son, reigning over the northern tribes of Israel already. And it wasn't till about 7.5 years later, after Saul had died, that David actually becomes king over all of Israel. There was 2 years when Ishbosheth was king over the northern tribes, and then there was 5 years of a bitter civil war and combat between Israel and Judah. Israel representing all the northern tribes and Judah representing the tribe of David. David, of course, was a Jew. Jew just means from the tribe of Judah. And when David finally did become king, he had to decide over both how he was going to unify them. Now, the tribes of Ephraim and Judah specifically had had a history going back an extra 500 years before this time of being not necessarily enemies, but being jealous of one another, especially Ephraim being jealous of Judah. The different tribes of Israel, there were 13 of them in all, and you can see that there would be this difficult situation created, especially during the time of Israel when he's conferring the blessings on the nation, on the different sons. In Genesis chapter 49, he gets them together, and this is, you know, a few hundred years, obviously, before David makes Jerusalem the capital of the Israelite state. This is the beginning of Israel with this family of Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel. And he's blessing his sons and his grandsons when it comes to the sons of Joseph. And you'll notice that there is an interesting blessing given to Judah, and then a very interesting blessing given to Joseph. Now, usually what would happen is both the leadership and the majority of the birthright goes to the oldest son. That's how it normally happens in ancient Israel. But in this case, Reuben was the eldest son of Jacob, but he lost his birthright because of a sinful act that he did with his father's concubine. And because of that, the birthright was not going to go to him. He lost it. And you can see from Genesis chapter 49 and even 1 Chronicles chapter 5, in verse 2, I believe it is, that it talks about how the birthright was to go to Joseph or the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. So they were to receive the birthright, that is the majority of the hereditary that was going to be passed down, or the blessings that would be passed down from generation to generation. And yet the leadership of the nation was going to go to Judah. Judah. So you're going to have a separation of the leadership and the birthright, and this created some animosity between those two tribes, Ephraim especially, because Ephraim was the head of Manasseh, was to be the leader over Manasseh, was to be greater than Manasseh, as the prophecy in Genesis chapter 48 talks about. And then there would be Judah towards the south of those territories, at least when they took the promised land, and there was a natural, human nature dictates that it's natural, but there was a animosity between those two tribes. Now, to make sure that they didn't come to fighting all the time, God put Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, right in between those two lands. The tribes of Ephraim and Judah were separated by Benjamin. Now, when David finally becomes king, again, he's king over Judah at the start, and it takes a while for the Israelites to come around and recognize David as their king. how could they be sure that David was going to treat them fairly? He was of the tribe of Judah. He wasn't of the tribe of Ephraim or any of the northern tribes, not of the tribe of Benjamin. How could they be sure that he would treat them fairly? So David had a big task on his hands as soon as he became king, and that was trying to unify the nation of Israel. And the policy that David did to unify Israel was choose Jerusalem. He chose Jerusalem. Now, this isn't some ethereal choosing of Jerusalem. This was a very critical and on a very practical level. Israel was in need of unity. The nation might have split apart forever at this point, but God, through David, rectified that, and it had everything to do with the city of Jerusalem and the throne that God was going to establish in that city, that he was going to establish in David in Jerusalem. So now, just a brief history of Jerusalem. You can see it mentioned in the Bible as Salem back in Genesis chapter 14, and Melchizedek was the king of Salem, Abraham, the father of really the Hebrews. He paid tithes to the king of Salem back in Genesis chapter 14. Melchizedek, or Melchizedek, is basically the king of righteousness, is what that name means. And we have that as kind of being the very earliest mention of Jerusalem in the Bible. And it's called, you can tell, Jerusalem, City of Peace, Salem there being the last part of Jerusalem. It's one and the same place. So you had that being, having this king of Salem, Melchizedek, being there, but you don't really hear it mentioned again until we have Joshua's period, when the Israelites are coming out of slavery, out of captivity through the period of the Exodus under Moses, and they come into the promised land under Joshua, and Jerusalem is now called Jebus, and the inhabitants of those cities were called Jebusites because they occupied this same city. Now, you can see from the Bible that Jebus is the same as Jerusalem. That's mentioned in a number of places. Now, there was an issue with Jebus because it was right on the edge of two territories that were given to two tribes. You had the tribe of Judah to the south and the tribe of Benjamin to the north. And right on the edge of theirs was this place called Jebus. Now, Joshua did not, it seems from the book of Joshua that Jebus wasn't necessarily conquered by him, but when you get to the start of the book of Judges, we have a partial conquering of Jebus. But then you can see from the later on in that chapter, Judges chapter 1 and verse 21, that the Benjamites didn't fully drive out the inhabitants of Jebus. It's only when you get to David's time, a full 400 years later, that Jebus is conquered. So you've got this period of the Judges and this period of Saul's reign, and yet Jebus, this city, right in the middle of the promised land, is not conquered. This was the city of God, and yet for 400 years, it was not belonging to the Israelites at all. Through the period of Samson, Ehud, Jephthah, Samuel even, through the reign of Saul, Jerusalem did not belong to the Israelites. So this was something that David saw that he needed to rectify once he became king. This city was important to him, but he saw that it was important to God as well. Let's just go to 2 Samuel chapter 5, and we'll see David's first act once he is made king. This is how important Jerusalem was to David. This is 2 Samuel chapter 5, and we'll read verse 1 to 5. It says this: "Then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron." So notice that when it says all the tribes of Israel, it's not referring to the tribe of Judah. It's just referring to those northern tribes that up to this point weren't allied with Israel. They had a separate state. This was not ruled over by David whatsoever. So they come to David, who's in Hebron, the capital of the tribe of Judah, and spoke, saying, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you that did lead out and bring in Israel. And the Eternal said to you, David, you shall feed my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel." So they remembered that, yes, David was the one that God wanted to be king over them. And they're coming to their senses, so they go down to Hebron to tell him this. And then they said, verse 3, so all the elders of Israel came to the king, to Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them in Hebron before the Eternal, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was already anointed. He was anointed king over Judah before this, but now he's made king over the northern tribes as well. Verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So finally, David is made king over the northern tribes, but he refuses at that point to rule from Hebron over all of Israel. He knew that would not unify this new nation. All of the tribes coming together. And his very first act as king was to take Jerusalem, was to finally take Jerusalem and choose that as the new capital for the entire nation. Notice this in verse 6. We just keep reading just from that previous verse. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke unto David, saying, except you take away the blind and the lame, you shall not come here, thinking David cannot come here. So basically, you have them marching to the Jebus, which had an amazing defense system from this period, continuing on from the Middle Bronze, probably the same walls that existed during Melchizedek's time, going the Jebusites still using those walls, and we're not really sure about the connection between the Jebusites and Melchizedek. It's not recorded in the Bible, and we don't really know from archaeology what that connection is. But nevertheless, this was a well-defended city and one of the reasons why it wasn't taken for so long. And they are saying, except, you know, it's very confusing, this verse, even in the Hebrew, but it probably means there could be blind and lame defending this city and still you wouldn't be able to take it because of its defenses. But David then says, verse 8, David said that day, whosoever smites the Jebusites and gets up to the gutter or the tsinor or some type of water pipe and takes away the lame and the blind that are hated of David's soul, wherefore they say, the blind and the lame, he cannot come into the house. And David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. So he was able to take it. We see from the other account that Joab, his nephew, was able to lead this attack going up through one of the water pipes or the water tunnels, probably down to the Gihon Spring, and could go into the city from the inside and attack it from there, open the city gates, and then Jerusalem was conquered, and David built up that stronghold, and he called it the City of David. So notice that. This is his first move. This was his highest priority after becoming king of those northern tribes as well. He recognizes the need to unify the nation and he moves the political capital of this new nation to Jerusalem. Now, this city obviously had some significance to it, to all the Israelites, going back to Abraham's time. But other than that, there's not much record of how important it was. But purely from a political standpoint, this city had been untainted by any prior division among the tribes. This was, again, on the border between Judah and Benjamin being part of Israel. This would be recognized by the northern tribes as a fresh start. The people in Israel would have welcomed the move, as it showed that David was going to rule over all Israel and strive to be unbiased towards both Judah and Israel. So obviously this would have had a unifying effect on the nation instantaneously, taking of Jerusalem and moving the capital there. But David wasn't done with Jerusalem, just ruling from Jerusalem. He also would establish Jerusalem as the religious center of the nation. Now, for us, thinking about Jerusalem, we think it's a no-brainer that Jerusalem, you know, that's where the temple was. This is the important religious place in ancient Israel. Well, until David's time, it wasn't. It wasn't. You had the Ark at different locations when it came into the Promised Land, being at Gilgal, Shiloh, Gibeon. That was the religious center, not Jerusalem. Yet David, when he made it the political capital, also sought to make Jerusalem the religious capital of the nation as well. Now, you'll remember going back to the time of Saul that in a very important battle, they lost the ark. They took the ark into battle against the Philistines in the battle at Aphek, and they lost the ark, and the ark went to a number of different Philistine cities, and the Philistines were cursed with some sicknesses and illnesses wherever that ark went. So eventually they got rid of the ark. They put it to they tied it to a couple of milk cows, and the milk cows, instead of going back to their calves, who were obviously bleating at the time, they went the opposite direction. They worked together, and these cows had never been put together in a yoke of oxen before, and they walked right down the road into Israelite territory. And they knew at that point, well, this is from God. The Philistines did, and then they recognized that God wanted the ark back in Israelite territory. Now, through the rest of, it would take a long time before the ark would make its way back into back into having a function in the Israelite religion. That would take David. And as soon as David does take Jerusalem of the Jerusalem, he then goes and searches out the ark. He wants to bring the ark there to get Israel's focus on Jerusalem religiously as well. Now, God would have loved his motivation here. And God, obviously, at the start, was a little disappointed in David, though, in the way that he tried to remove the ark and bring it to Jerusalem, because it was not done according to the law, and somebody had to die because of that. And then David learned the lesson, God has rules for how I treat his religion, how I treat the ark. And so he got the Levites to carry it correctly, and it was brought into Jerusalem with much celebration and much fanfare. He sets up a tent right down by the Gihon Spring in Jerusalem, and he puts it there. Now, there's also a problem at this point, though, because right at this time, there's still the tabernacle functioning. It doesn't have the ark in it, but it's still functioning, and the tabernacle is at Gibeon, outside of Jerusalem. And there was a bit of a division here between the religious centers. You had the Ark in Jerusalem, who had some priests over it and attending to that, and you had the tent of, the tabernacle being in Gibeon. So what does God do next through David? Well, David realizes that God needs to dwell in a permanent house in Jerusalem. Up until this point, there's no mention of a temple anywhere. And as far as we can tell, the first mention of an actual structure building with stone walls for God to dwell in, that came from David. And we'll see that. Let's go over to 1 Chronicles chapter 17. So he established Jerusalem as the religious center by first bringing the ark there, but then by building the temple. He wanted to make it fixed, that Israel would look to Jerusalem as its spiritual capital, not just its political capital. This is 1 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 1 to 6. And this, God was really blown away by David's attitude here. It says, "And it came to pass, when David dwelt in his house," that is his palace, which we're going to see today, "that David said to Nathan the prophet, 'Lo, I dwell in a house of cedar.'" He's sitting there looking around, and he sees his beautiful house that the Phoenicians helped him build a few years previous. And he says, "I dwell in this house of cedar, but the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal dwells under curtains? There's something wrong here. I've got a fixed abode. It's beautiful. And while that tent might be nice, it's still curtains. It's not fixed. It's not beautiful. God deserves better." Now, this was David, the deep thinker, meditating about this. Then Nathan the prophet came to him, verse 2, and said unto David, "Do all that is in your heart, for God is with you." So Nathan, I don't know if he was being hasty here, but he says, God's with you, do what you think is best. Verse 3, "And it came to pass the same night that the word of God came to Nathan, saying, 'Go and tell David, my servant, thus says the Eternal, you shall not build me a house to dwell in, for I have not dwelt in a house since the day that I brought up Israel unto this day, but have gone from tent to tent and from one tabernacle to another. Now, we could sense that God was upset with David by this thought, but that's not the sense that we need to get here. It's just saying that David's not going to build the house. God loves the idea, and God is amazed by David that he had this idea, but he's not going to get to do it. And other scriptures talk about it. The reason is because he was a bloody man. He had fought battles. He has blood on his hands. And this was going to be God's temple, God's house. He wanted somebody that didn't have blood on their hands to build it. And that's why Solomon would get to build it. Nevertheless, God says here through Nathan that I've gone from tent to tent, from one tabernacle to another. Then verse 6, in all the places where I've walked among all Israel, spoke I a word with any of the judges of Israel, the leaders, whom I commanded to feed my people, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? God's just thinking here, in all those hundreds of years, I didn't, you know, talk to one of the leaders of Israel and say, why haven't you built me a house of cedar? Why haven't you done this? God didn't ask anyone to build him a permanent structure. And yet David thought that it was not right that God dwelt in a tent when he dwelt in a palace. And he thought God needs a temple. And that structure, that temple, needs to be in Jerusalem. Now look at God's response to this. This is in the other version of these events from 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 8 to 17. Just after God says that he didn't ask anyone else to build him a house through these 400 years, then he tells David, Nathan the prophet, to tell David this. Now therefore thus shall you say unto my servant David, thus says the Eternal of hosts, I took you from the sheepcote, from following sheep, that you should be prince over my people, over Israel. And I have been with you whithersoever you did go, and have cut off all your enemies before you, and I will make you a great name unto all the names of the great ones that are here in the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in their place and be disquieted no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as at the first, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will cause you to rest from all your enemies. So a lot of blessings that were coming upon David, and then it would flow into Solomon's reign. Then he writes this, he tells Nathan to tell David this. Moreover, the Eternal tells you that the Eternal will make you a house. Notice that. David wants to build God a house. God turns around and says, you can't build it, but I love the idea. And in fact, I am going to make you a house, David. You are going to be a house. Now, what does God mean here? Well, let's read on. Verse 12, when your days are fulfilled and you shall sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you that shall proceed out of your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Wow. He shall build a house for my name, that is Solomon, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Notice that. Notice that God conferring upon David this endless throne where his seed would be on the throne of Israel forever, that was a direct result from David wanting to set up God a house, a temple in Jerusalem. Then with this son, this verse 14, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. If he commits sin, I will chasten him with the rod of men and the stripes of the children of men, but my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, and I will not put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak unto David. So this passage here in 2 Samuel chapter 7 is one of the most critical passages in the entire Bible. And it relates to God's response to David for wanting to build up a temple for him in Jerusalem. And God said, well, I'm going to make you a house, David. Your family line on the throne of Israel is going to continue forever. Saul was on that, But he sinned, and I took it away from him, and I gave it to you. But even if you sin, or if your son sins, and if his son sins, I will chasten him. I will correct him. I will punish him. I might even send them into captivity. But the throne, the kingly line that is going to come through you as of the tribe of Judah, fulfilling Genesis chapter 49 and verse 10, that the scepter, the kingly line, shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh come, until the Messiah comes. There is going to be a kingly line that continues all the way down through history to the Messiah comes. Jeremiah chapter 33 and verse 16 and 17. Same thing. I make a promise, this promise that Jeremiah let be known once again, that if you still see the sun, if you still see the moon, then the promise to David that his seed will be on a throne still lives. Now today, people think that that throne is gone. People think that that throne is over. Then you must then discredit God and say that God was lying right here in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And you must say that Jeremiah was lying in Jeremiah chapter 33 if that throne doesn't exist. But that throne does exist still. We have a book, it's called The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and it proves that that throne still exists on this earth today, and you can request that. I'll leave the link for you to request that if you want to go back and look at that this history and see how this promise is still being fulfilled. But notice again that this was in response to David wanting to build God a house in Jerusalem. And, you know, you look at, you just think about some of these biblical minimalists, even in the archaeological field, that want to dismiss David and Solomon as not really being that important. But in doing that, they are really dismissing this, dismissing Jerusalem, for one, as being the capital or the massive capital of this kingdom, but they're also trying to do away with this beautiful promise that God gave to David as well, that of this continuous family line that would come out of his loins. Now, David, he wasn't allowed to build the temple, but Solomon did. But before Solomon came along, while he was growing up and David still reigned, man, did David prepare for that temple in a way that is absolutely amazing. He prepared all the different stones and the vessels. God showed him exactly where the temple was to be constructed. David even built a small altar right there where the altar of burnt sacrifice was going to be placed. And David did all he could. And basically, it came along when David was about to die. He got in his hand. You can see this in at the end of 1 Chronicles, that David is standing before Solomon, his son, before all the nobles of Judah, and he's got something in his hand. He's got the plans of the very temple of God that God gave to him and that David drew himself. And he passes that to Solomon and says, "It's time for you to build it." And then Solomon would go ahead and build that. Now, we focus on Solomon being the great builder, and he was, but he was just basically fulfilling what David told him. And David was the motivator here behind the temple's construction, and Solomon went ahead and fulfilled that. And you also notice what else David did. He not only moved the ark to Jerusalem, he not only started to get this temple project underway, he also started to make sure that there was a priestly order to govern the way that that temple would operate and function. And you can see, looking through 1 Chronicles chapters 22 to 29, and you see there that David is talking about the different priestly orders that were to assist in the temple and the way that it would function. He talks about the musicians that were to be set up and the family lines that would be dedicated to the music of God inside the temple as well. This was important. This was important. There's no point having a temple if there's no one there to work it. And so David set that up as well. And obviously God led him to do that. Now, this is an incredible history that's detailed a lot in the book of Chronicles. The book of Chronicles, unlike the Book of Kings, it focuses on this kingly line. It focuses around the promise of 2 Samuel chapter 7 about this kingly line that was to be perpetuated from David onwards. And it focuses on Jerusalem, and it focuses on the temple being built and how David set it up. And then right at the end, or the second half of that, once you get into 2 Chronicles, it talks about it being built under Solomon. And you know what? That temple was built, and it was in, according to the UN, again, East Jerusalem, area that doesn't belong to the Jews. UN Resolution 2334 says the Jews are occupying illegal land that belongs to the Palestinians. Well, tell that to David, if he was here, that before he came along, the city belonged to the Jebusites. East Jerusalem belonged to the Jebusites. He conquered it, and he builds it up. And he builds a temple right where God tells him to build it. Now, you can see why the Jews might be upset of when somebody says that they have no claim to East Jerusalem. They go back to this scripture, these scriptures, and say, well, actually, God built his temple here. God gave the plans to David. He showed him where it should be built. And we're going to fight tooth and nail to keep this land that we belong rightfully, that we believe rightly belongs to us. Well, I'm not going to get into the politics of it today at all. I'm simply on this tour going to show Melanie Phillips and some of her friends that these are the walls, these are the stones of the kings David and Solomon. And they're massive. And they're right here in Jerusalem, right where the Bible says that they should be. And if you're in Jerusalem, you need to go and check out this site, especially the Ophel. I mean, the city of David, that's more well known. The Palace of David has massive walls, and you need to go and see that as well. And they are dated from the right time, sure. They don't have David written on them, yet they're huge. They're from the right biblical period. And the Bible says that David built a palace, and his palace, according to biblical geography, should be around there. So if it's not David's palace, what is it? But I think it is David's palace. But you also have the Ophel, where excavations are more ongoing there. And there is, over the last couple of years, the archaeological park has developed. In the very southeastern corner of the archaeological park is where you'll find a city gate from King Solomon's time. Now, you have to walk through the whole park to get there, and there's not really the best signage to get there. I mean, if I was running this tourist site, I would be directing people to this with huge arrows, huge signs saying King Solomon reigned, and here is something that he built. But it isn't that well documented, at least till you get down there to the southeastern corner. Keep walking through the park, and you'll be amazed, I think, that you look there, you just stand there right below the huge southern wall of the Temple Mount, and you're looking at something that existed 1,000 years before that, built by Solomon, the son of King David. Go and check out that site. If you can't come to Jerusalem to visit that site, then we have the website, keytodavidcity.com, keytodavidcity.com, which details the excavations there. It doesn't have too much on that site about King Solomon because the publication process is still in flux. We are, Dr. Ilat Mazar is working very busily with her team at Hebrew University to publish those excavations, which details the strong case for King Solomon being the constructor of this massive building there in Jerusalem. And then, of course, we have our own website, watchjerusalem.co.il, where we will be updating our archaeological page very soon. That will be more user-friendly and help you go through this history and look at what's been discovered in a clean manner and something that is hopefully not complicated at all as well. So please check out that site, watchjerusalem.co.il. If you have any feedback for this show or the site, you can send that to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. You can also like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at watch_Jerusalem. And you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter we have now, which, in case you don't go back to the site during the week, we'll send an email update every Friday morning Jerusalem time straight to your inbox, which will tell you what you've missed. Thanks for listening today. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, coming to you again from Jerusalem, Israel. And you've been listening to the program Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.